right, what's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of the A10 Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Basil. And if you're an A10 fan or just an A10 casual fan of college basketball, you might be aware that this week, Wednesday and Thursday, were A10 Media Days. So, you know, after a long offseason, we finally got to get the first look at how some of these A10 programs are planning out their season, you know, adjusting their rosters and getting ready for the 2021-2022 season. So, you know, with me this week, I have two great co-hosts, both A10 Talk contributors. First up, mainly a SLU contributor, we got Grant Hogan, and a VCU contributor, Jason Bowman. How you guys doing?
Doing all right. You know, learning a lot from Media Day. What are we, about 2 weeks from the season? Something like that. So just counting down the days and really excited to hopefully be back in the gym this fall and excited for basketball to get going again.
Yeah, it's really gearing up here, coming up onto us a little faster than, you know, we expected. It's been a couple hundred days since we've seen an A10 basketball game, so definitely excited.
Yeah, it's definitely been a great way to, you know, kind of scratch that itch that we've all been feeling this summer. You know, we're, I believe, as of the recording of this, 12 days away from the opening of the season. So, you know, let's get right into it, starting off with St. Louis. St. Louis and VCU both went on the second day of Media Day. And I think there, you know, there was a lot going on within the program, you know, in the past 24 hours leading up to Media Day, in the past 6 months, in the past year. But first, let's talk about, you know, the biggest news that came out of SLU this week. Very unfortunate news with the injury of Javonte Perkins. It looks like he tore his ACL during some sort of scrimmage or practice, and he's not expected to recover by the end of the season. So, you know, Grant, how does this impact St. Louis?
Yeah, so the major takeaway, I think, it was an exhibition against D3, I think, Rutgers University from Kansas City, small school. Just something to drum up some fan interest and get the players' legs fresh. And he went into the paint and landed awkwardly and looks like he tore his ACL. So out for the year, which is a really big hit for SLU, considering he was their leading scorer last year, even with Jordan Goodwin and Hassan French in the fold. They're already looking to replace those two who, you know, were program staples and even program legends, you know, trying to usher in this new Travis Ford era over the last few years. So Perkins is really, filling that role of not just a bridge guy, because he's much more than that, but bridging the old era with the new era. The entire offense was going to run through him. He's a three-level scorer. He can get a basket whenever the offense stalls. He can play ISO. He can spot up. He can do it all. And that's why he was first team all conference. I think they released either yesterday or 2 days ago. But yeah, an A10 player of the year candidate for sure. So it's definitely going to hamper a lot of the expectations around this team. But this is one of the deeper rosters that SLU's seen in previous years. I think this is Coach Ford's fifth season with the team. So he's kind of finally able to get all his own guys in here, his own recruiting classes. So this will be a testament to how he's assembled this program to handle any kind of adversity. And I think that we'll see more of a collective effort from the role players on the team rather than just seeing one guy step up and take up all his minutes. This bench is about 10 or 11 scholarship players deep. So I'm looking for Coach Ford to try to implement some different strategies using the strengths of these bench players.
And so, you know, regarding Javonte, you know, I think I really liked what Coach Ford said today during Media Day. I mean, obviously, Coach Ford's been there for a long time. You're saying it's probably his fourth or fifth year with the team. We know he's a smart guy. We know he cares about his players. But he basically said that, you know, the focus now is not really what are we missing, but rather, you know, how are we going to work around it? Not in the sense that, you know, oh, you know, a guy injured, that's fine. We'll just fill in the spaces. Obviously, it's a huge blow. But what is Coach Ford going to be able to do? Who's going to fill in the shoes of Javonte?
Right. Yeah. So obviously, like I said, I actually wrote an article on it this morning, but it's not really the initial plan, at least, is not going to be one guy stepping up and being the guy who can score 30 points in a night. Javonte Perkins don't grow on trees, unfortunately, for SLU. But I think what you're going to see is you're going to see more of a lot more of Terrence Hargrove has been a guy that a lot of people around the program are getting really excited about. He's entering his third year, really explosive energizer bunny type bench guy. I'm looking for him to eat up some big valuable wing minutes. Fred Thatch, the team captain, he's actually, I think, now the most senior player on the team, even though he has a couple years of eligibility left. He's going to be expected to put in good minutes. You got to look at, I think, the way Coach Ford talked about the way that the offense is going to run. He said they wanted to play fast coming into the year. That was the identity they were looking to work through. And he said they might even have to play faster using their defense to generate offense because, you know, guys, and Javonte Perkins is the kind of guy who can take over in the half court. Without that talent, that level of a scorer, you might have to generate offense through fast break and transition offense, which is kind of the way the modern game's going anyway. So that might be a blessing in disguise for the way that this program's built. But you're going to see a lot more. Yuri Collins is a guy who he's entering his third season with the team. He's had the keys to the offense since day one as a true freshman starting at point guard position. But now, you know, the training wheels are off, and I think they've been off, but now without Goodwin and now even Perkins to compliment him in the backcourt, he's a guy who's only scores about 5 points a game in his career, but we might have to ask him to, create more and dribble penetrate to take tough looks and finish at the rim. On top of his, he's one of the top playmakers in the country. He's gonna dribble through traffic. He's gonna find the open guy in the wing. He's gonna run the pick and roll efficiently. So I think you're gonna see the offense take a different shape this year, not just because of the loss of Javonte, but just even in coming into a new season. A couple transfers like Rashad Williams and DeAndre Jones are proficient 3-point shooters, something that SLU hasn't had in the last five years or so. So you're going to see a lot more spacing on the offensive side of the ball, which is going to open up a guy like Francis Okoro, who's the highly touted Oregon transfer. He's going to be given some good matchups in the post off the pick and roll. And Yuri's going to have to really step up his game, I think. And I think he can. I think this is a breakout year potential for him. But especially without Perkins, we're going to have to see a lot more creativity on the offensive side of the ball.
I'm glad you brought up Francis Okoro because I think he's really probably one of the most interesting incoming transfers to the Atlantic 10. Obviously, Oregon is a Pac-12 school, Power 5 school. What do you think drew him to St. Louis?
So talking about Francis Okoro, and you talk about he's a Power 5 guy, he's an Oregon guy. I believe he played two seasons at Oregon. He transferred, sat out this past season. So he was with the program last year. He's practicing with the team. So he does have a good understanding of the system. He's from Normal, Illinois, which is about two and a half hours east of St. Louis. I believe he had some kind of family tragedy or something that led him wanting to be closer to home. I believe we were on him in the recruiting cycle. I know he was talking to, I think Illinois was in on him and maybe even Missouri. So he was talking to some other local teams. So that was a huge get for Coach Ford a couple of years ago. But you want to talk about what he can do for the program. We're losing Hassan French, who, as a lot of Billiken fans know, was one of the, he kind of took us out of those dark days under towards the end of Jim Crew's era when we were, cellar dwellers in the A-10. You know, he was, him and Jordan Goodwin kind of were the spearhead of that rebuild that, led us to a tournament berth and even a top 25 ranking at some point. But Francis Okoro, he's bigger and as big and strong as Hassan French is. Francis Okoro's even bigger. He's like 6'9", I think, 250. He's an NBA frame type body. He's a highly touted recruit. He's going to work the glass on the defense and the offensive side of the ball. He's going to be, have some gravity, provide gravity to allow more spacing for shooters, because if you give him a mismatch down low, he's just going to eat low post defenders up. So he's definitely someone that in the program and around, there's a lot of buzz around Francis Okoro and what he can do for this team. Yeah, he's definitely going to have a big role to play. And I think, again, without Javonte Perkins, everyone's role has just taken another step up. So I definitely am looking for him to show out for the Billikens this year.
Definitely. Definitely one of the biggest incoming transfers to watch. And so, Jason, my question for you is, kind of pushing back towards last season, Grant, you mentioned, St. Louis really wants to hit the ground running. So, Jason, do you really think it's because of how last season kind of ended? I mean, St. Louis, in my opinion, probably got hit with one of the worst COVID pauses in the conference, more so than a school like Fordham, who couldn't even start their season until I think after New Year's. They started in January right into conference play. But St. Louis, they had a really strong non-conference schedule. They played very well. They were, I think, up to top 20 in the nation. And then they didn't play a game from December 23rd to January 26th. And then, you know, they missed this. They got knocked out in the semifinals of the Atlantic 10 tournament, and they just, you know, couldn't get it back together. So how much do you think that pause kind of affected the second half of their season?
Well, first off, I will say it was very difficult last year to kind of evaluate St. Louis as someone who obviously doesn't know as much from being kind of an outsider, but someone who doesn't know the program intricately, because they looked awesome, but then they stopped playing, like you said. And it felt like it was even longer than the time frame you said. You gave a time frame about a month. It felt like, because it was a very pivotal month. It's like when you know what teams are separating themselves, that December, January type period. So it was very strange. I know doing our weekly power rankings on A10 Talk, it was very difficult because having a team that never plays as your number one is kind of, but I thought St. Louis was the best team last year up until Bonaventure really broke out. Hopefully my VCU colleagues don't like rip my head off for that, but I definitely thought St. Louis was awesome. I'm really bummed about Perkins because I was really excited to see what he was going to be able to do. But as for how that maybe translates into this year, I think it probably gives more motivation this year, hopefully, is a lot more normal than last year. Hopefully last year never gets repeated again, because last year was just incredibly difficult to manage for all college athletics. But yeah, I think it provides good motivation. I know the Perkins injury really, really kind of puts a damper on things, but I think St. Louis will come out strong. Travis Ford is one of the best coaches in the conference. Very much looking forward to seeing how they're able to kind of overcome all these changes. And yeah, again, that big COVID pause kind of hurt their momentum. I believe that's the thing that separated them from at least the at-large berth, is losing those games and losing that ability to, one, gel better as a team, and two, really get in front of the NCAA voters, committee, the media, and everybody saying, wow, this team is really good. They kind of lost that opportunity, and of course lost the opportunity to take the top two seeds in the conference and ended up getting bounced in the semifinals. But they were a better team than that last year, and they're definitely going to be one to watch this year for sure.
So what's a realistic goal for St. Louis heading into 2021, considering what they're building off from last year? And with everything going on, you know, within the team with Javonte Perkins, is it an A-10 title? Is it an at-large bid? I mean, what would you think?
Yeah, so again, like, I think that Coach Ford's assembled a really talented team that can withstand injuries. But of course, Javonte Perkins is the last player on the team that we would have, you don't want anyone to get injured, but he's the last player on the team that you want to see go down, because your whole team kind of depend, your whole game plan depends on his abilities and his performance. But you know, from, I think this team could, there's a kind of a wide range of outcomes that could come about this year. I can't remember who did this, but there's someone, I think he was like CBS Sports ranked the top, like every team 1 to 356 or something. And they had SLU came in about 66, and he was, and the writer defined them as an NIT at worst team. And I think he had Bonaventure and Richmond ahead of them. So the third best team in the conference he had us listed as, which I think you're seeing a lot of the preseason poll just came out. They had SLU behind St. Bonaventure and Richmond as third in the preseason poll. I think that's a legitimate goal, is to, you know, go into the tournament as one of the top level teams in the conference. There's a really tough non-conference schedule that I think we might see some growing pains in the adjustment to losing Javonte Perkins so close to that slate. This is a team that, kind of counter to how last year transpired, I think you're looking at a team that will maybe have some growing pains in the non-conference, but really come into form in conference play. And I definitely think Bonaventure is the clear favorite to win this conference, but I don't think there's anything to suggest that SLU won't be able to outperform the Richmonds and the VCUs and Daytons of the world. While I think all of those teams have a legitimate claim to that number two spot in the conference. All that to say, I think that, you know, the team finished a spot or two off the bubble last year, given all of the complications. It really is going to depend on a few guys kind of stepping up and some of the younger guys living up to their potential faster. And the guy who I haven't even talked about, Jordan Nesbitt, who's one of the, I think he's one of the better transfers in the country. He was a top 50 recruit coming out of high school from St. Louis Christian. He went to Memphis to play for Penny Hardaway, barely played, transferred at the semester. He's a guy that I think when I was at the inter-squad scrimmage a couple weekends ago, and he was with Javonte on the court. He was the best player. I think he scored like 25 points in 32 minutes or something. He's a guy that, when we talk about Francis Okoro being a power five transfer, this is a program that Travis Ford is not going for mid-major talent. And John Rothstein always says that the Atlantic 10 is not a mid-major conference, but these are high major players that are on the SLU roster, and they're not going to settle. They will not see anything less than an NCAA tournament bid as a success, in my opinion. I think they're really gunning for that. I think they're going to have to assemble an at-large bid given the strength of St. Bonaventure. But I think we can all agree here that the Atlantic 10 is not a one bid conference. I think there's multiple bids to be had here. I think St. Louis has a real, I think we have a real chance for one of those. And I think the talent's there, but without Javonte Perkins, it definitely muddles things. And it's something that we'll definitely get a better idea of this team's identity soon. Cause I think they play at Memphis on like November 14th or something. So less than 3 weeks away from playing, you know, the best player in the country, arguably, in Amone Bates, and in a hostile Memphis environment.
I'm glad you bring up that Memphis game, which is on the November 16th in Memphis, okay. I believe. That's kind of the last topic I wanted to talk about SLU tonight. Would you say Memphis is their best, but their most important non-conference game in trying to get an at-large bid?
So I think Memphis is the obvious selection. You know, if you look at their schedule, you see at Memphis, that's a pure quad one opportunity in every sense of the word. If you have quad one, referring to the net rankings, whether in the venue, whether it's home, road, or a neutral site. So yeah, Memphis is going to be there at the end of the season. That will be their either their best win or the best loss. I don't think, I think even above a St. Bonaventure, because Memphis is really, you know, Penny Hardaway's trying to build something with a lot of talented freshmen wanting to come play for Penny Hardaway in Memphis. So it's definitely, that's a game to look for. But I actually think the one that's most important would be there's a home game against Auburn in December. And Bruce Pearl's got a really good Auburn team this year. They're definitely going to be, I think, a ranked team and maybe a top five or six seed in the tournament. But you bring them into Chaffetz. It's a long commute from Auburn, Alabama. That's a game that if SLU wants to vie for an at-large bid, that's kind of a game you really want to win to boost that resume. So I would actually say Auburn at home is the most important, with honorable mentions of at Boise State, who was another bubble team last year. They played Drake on a neutral floor, I think in Las Vegas. And then a sneaky one, I think, is we have Belmont at home, and Belmont's always a team that wins 25 games in the Ohio Valley. They're always around that 13 seed. They're always flirting with that at-large bubble spot. So yeah, I would say Auburn's the biggest game, but I think Coach Ford's done a really good job at assembling a commendable schedule in the non-conference to, you know, support this team's bid for at-large selection to the tournament.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad you bring up Chaffetz Arena when talking about the Auburn game, because I really do think Chaffetz Arena is kind of an underrated venue in college basketball, both in terms of the look of it. I mean, it's great, it's compact, and the atmosphere. I went there once while working for Fordham Radio to cover a Fordham SLU game, and it was probably one of the coolest away venues I've been to. So kind of shifting over to Jason Moore, your expertise, VCU, going into this season, VCU was the only team in the entire NCAA tournament to have to forfeit a game due to a positive COVID test. Drew, the A-10 media representative, kind of said something about it to Coach Rhodes today, kind of poking at him a little bit. And, Coach Rhodes, kind of came back at him, but it seems like that's something that, still kind of weighs on the minds of the VCU team. How much do you think that missed opportunity kind of sets the tone for VCU this year?
Well, I think you have to remember too, how the season two seasons ago ended at the Barclays Center. I know it ended for everybody kind of bad. I mean, it was scary being there in New York covering for, I worked for VCU Radio at the time. It was scary because you didn't really know how the COVID pandemic was going to work out. But the reason I was in the arena for VCU Radio when the tournament got canceled was because VCU and UMass were on the floor warming up, because they were the first game of the day on that Thursday when the season ended. So say you're a freshman, say you're, I can't think of who's a junior on top of my head, Watkins. That's a bad example because he's injured. His freshman year, he was a freshman last year. However, just say hypothetical junior, your freshman year, you're playing 19-20, you're tournament's canceled because you're on the floor doing warmups, and then this virus comes up. 1 year later, you go through the tournament, whatever, cool, we got an at-large bid. That's awesome. You go travel to Indianapolis for the tournament, and then hours before your game, dinner time, it's wiped out again because of positive COVID tests. So that's 2 years in a row where you're hours away from playing probably the biggest game of your collegiate career, and it's just wiped away. It's horrible. I mean, it's heartbreaking is the word to say. And I know we're going to hear the coach speak from Coach Rhodes and the players that were there last year, and especially the players that have been there for both years, about how we just move on, blah, 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 all that stuff. But mentally, it has to be at least in the back of your mind. It's just a tough way to end. But I think it's also motivation as well. It's all right. We went to the NCAA tournament last year. Last year we didn't get to play. Let's go back this year and show them what they missed out on, you know? So I think it's motivation for them, and you kind of saw it in Coach Rhodes' response as well. I know he took it good humorously, but he's probably tired of hearing about it because it comes up a lot because it's so unique. And it was a devastating way for the season to end. Again, the only team that ended their season, not with a loss, but with the chance to not even play. So I'm sure they're ready to get on the floor and get that behind them. But yeah, when you combine the last two seasons, it's a lot, just horrible endings for VCU in the last couple of years. So I'm sure that's bulletin board material. They put that on the board and go, hey, let's go back there and let's pick up a couple wins and show them what they missed out on last year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, going into the season, it's probably going to be, you know, something that they're going to, you know, not correct because it wasn't their fault, but take advantage of it and trying to have just another opportunity to get into the NCAA tournament. And one of the biggest questions, you know, from that missed opportunity was, what would Bones Highland be able to do on the biggest stage in college basketball? You know, now he's left VCU. He's in the NBA playing for the Denver Nuggets. But what would you say is Bones's legacy at VCU? I mean, how does, you know, the way that season ended, you know, how does that change the impact he made on that school as a player?
I don't know if it changes it much at all. I mean, it would have been nice to have the resume pieces. Again, the most iconic moments in VCU basketball revolve around the NCAA tournament. Eric Maynard's shot against Duke, and then obviously the Final Four run 10 years ago. So it would have been nice for Bones to have sort of his Eric Maynard moment or his Joey Rodriguez moment, things like that. But his legacy is pretty secure because it's so rare. It happens every so often, but it's so rare for an NBA player to come from VCU, especially to be drafted in the first round. I think Bones is only the 11th or 12th VCU player to ever play in the league, having made his debut Monday night, officially playing in the league, now that Michael Malone's kind of working in the rotation. But his legacy at VCU is pretty secure even without the tournament. The way he played, just super positive all the time. You see that in his tweets of all the emojis and things, is the energy he brought on the floor. He was the prototypical Mike Rhodes guard, shot a lot of threes, always played hard, had a lot of fun. Honestly, I think if Mike Rhodes could have gone to a lab and created his perfect guard, his perfect shooting guard, it would have been Bones Highland. And again, that's also for the future. You go, hey, Bones Highland came from here and he's at least, fingers crossed, a rotational piece in the NBA, kind of like Obi Toppin. He didn't get to play in the tournament the year he was. Well, he is a lot better player than Highland because he was National Player of the Year. But now Dayton can look at that and go, hey, this guy had a huge impact. He got drafted in the NBA. Now he's playing really good minutes with New York. So it's the same but different, if that makes sense. His legacy is secure about the tournament. But shoot, I wish he would have had the chance because he was built for those big moments. Would have been a lot of fun to see him shoot threes up in Indianapolis.
Yeah, and so, you know, I don't think that Bones Highland Obi Toppin comparison is outlandish as you might say. I mean, there is a bit of a talent gap. I would say Obi is the better player considering the awards he racked up in college, but I mean, it's almost parallel career moments. And so, now that Bones is gone, there's a couple guys that could, you know, kind of step in and fill the shoes to be the guy at VCU. One of them, Ace Baldwin, might have to take a bit more time because he's currently, you know, nursing an injury. Interestingly enough, they're saying that he will probably just miss non-conference play and then be ready to go for conference play in mid to late December. Do you think that's going to cause kind of a first half identity to VCU and then a second half identity to VCU, you know, at different points in the season? Do you think Hassan Ward is going to have his work cut out for him in non-conference play?
Yes and no about the Hassan Ward point. Yes, I mean, I think I don't know if he's the front runner, but he's certainly on the short list for Conference Defensive Player of the Year. He's very good at his role being essentially the center on the team, but he's got a decent amount of help. I liked what Coach Rhodes said today at A-10 Media Day. He spent a lot of time talking about his seniors, especially the two that were on the stage, Keyshawn Curry and Levi Stockard being a graduate student, his fifth year, transfer out of Kansas State a couple years ago. So he's got tons of collegiate experience. Stockard is not as talented as, say, Curry or the other senior, who I think is the sleeper pick that some people are forgetting about. I believe he was all-conference second team preseason, Vince Williams. He'll be the scorer going into the season. So Ward does have his work cut out for him, I'm sure. Teams are game planning around him, and I'm worried that teams might be able to try to game plan him out, but he's a really good defensive player and hopefully overcome that. I think Williams will bear the brunt of the scoring load in the beginning of the season. Stockard obviously will play his role. Keyshawn Curry, I don't know if he would have started before the injury started racking up, especially with Rhodes saying today that Jameer Watkins would have started. He slipped that in a little nugget, but now Watkins out for the season with the ACL injury. So Curry will definitely have to take on a bigger role, but again, with the experience. I think Rhodes will lean a lot on experience in the first half. As for shifting identities, hopefully Ace Baldwin's back by conference play. I still think it's optimistic considering his Achilles injury, one of the most severe injuries you can get as a basketball player. Couple that with when he suffered the injury. But if they say he's good to go, I guess he's good to go. But say he comes back January 1 and they split the season directly in half, I'm struggling to know who's going to handle the ball in the first half besides these freshman guards they're bringing in, because there's not really an experienced ball handler on the team. So I worry about potential turnovers, things like that, because the Mike Rhodes offense depends on that dependable ball handler. You see it with Marcus Evans, guys like that, people that could really pass. Going back to early days of Mike Rhodes, Johnny Williams wasn't really much of a scorer, but he could really drop dimes. Sean Mobley as a forward was really underrated as a passer. I don't see who's the really good passer that's on this offense. Maybe somebody will be able to step up. And obviously when Baldwin comes in the second half, he'll take that role. He's one of the best players at being able to create assists in the conference last year, I believe, especially at the age he was at. But yeah, I'm worried about rust maybe when Baldwin comes back in, worried about kind of the adjustments. But to cap off on a positive note for BCU fans, I liked what Keyshawn Curry said today about, sure, there's a lot of change. Highland's gone, a lot of injuries, a lot of turnover. But essentially, things run the same, just with different people. So if you take him at his word, that's something for BCU fans to hold on to, that hopefully the offense doesn't look that different and somebody, maybe even Curry, can step up and be that ball handler.
So if the offense does end up having to look a bit different, what do you think Mike Rhodes could change? I mean, do you think he could have a de-emphasis on shooting? Could he work more? Do you think Mike Rhodes has a team that's equipped to maybe work a bit more down low?
Yeah, obviously with Ward, I think Williams always worked well down low. He's expanded his game a lot, shooting a lot of threes. We saw a huge step up in threes. Not saying Vince Williams is Giannis, because he's not, but I think of how Giannis in the NBA was able to change his game and shoot more threes. Brooke Lopez might be a better comparison in the NBA, how he never shot threes and then all of a sudden could shoot them very well. We saw that with Vince Williams last year. So the offense will be fine. It's just the problem is with the experience. I wonder if you maybe need to make it less complicated. They play at such a fast pace, maybe try to slow it down because you don't have the depth. What if some people start getting tired? Injuries have racked up already with McAllister, Watkins, and Baldwin. But I think Rhodes is kind of trying to shy away from that. He did say that this offense is complex, but the freshmen coming in and your transfers, Nichols and Sahonis, they came in wanting to play that style. So he says that he should be able to jump right into it. So to answer your original question, I do think they'll kind of have to simplify things a little bit, at least initially for the younger players coming in. But I don't think Rhodes really sees a big issue, because he seems to think, and I agree, that the players can have come to play the Mike Rhodes style and that they'll easily learn it.
Non-conference play is a good time to test out new game plans, work on different play styles. What is the most important game to you that VCU needs to win? Or what's also the most important game for them to kind of adapt into this new team identity?
I have a few answers to that. Most important game you need to win. I circle the biggest opportunity, which I think is the biggest game you need to win. December 18th, a home game against Penn State. They played Penn State on the road last year, lost on a buzzer beater in three in Pennsylvania. So I know Penn State, it's still a power conference school. It's still a school that you kind of circle on your calendar as, wow, that's a big name, even though their basketball legacy isn't as big as, say, its football legacy. But that's still an important one to pick up. Could be a good quadrant win. And at home, you got to pick up all your home games, especially your VCU. You can only afford to drop one or two home games because, one, you have the big home floor advantage. Two, with the way net and everything's calculated, home losses hurt you so much more than road and neutral losses. In terms of getting kind of the bugs out of the system, the start of the season, you kind of play lesser caliber teams. They're still good teams. All the teams in NCAA are good. You play St. Peter's to open up the season. Wagner on homecoming. Seems like they play Wagner a lot. Both of those are home games. Good opportunity to kind of knock the bugs out. Chattanooga at home as well. But kind of go off on a little tangent of the non-conference games. I do really like the MTE that they've joined, the multi-team event with the Battle for Atlantis, being able to play Syracuse on a neutral floor. That's going to be a huge game for VCU, and that'll really be the measuring stick as to, okay, we had a few games to kind of shake it out. We had one road game at Vanderbilt, a few home games against teams they should beat easily. So we've kind of got the offense going. Now let's play a team that went deep in the tournament last year and see how they measure up against tournament caliber teams like Syracuse. Syracuse returning a lot of good players. Jim Boeheim, of course, a legend. And that's the game I kind of circle as the most game I most anticipate. But to answer your original question, I look at Penn State in December as the must win. This is the game here at the Siegel Center.
Yeah, so you bring up the Battle for Atlantis. The Battle for Atlantis has probably always been one of my favorite MTEs of, you know, kind of the non-conference portion of the season. You know, it's always got that cool court. There's always, you know, fun teams involved. You bring up Syracuse, but this is not a definite. VCU could have an opportunity to take on the defending national champions in Baylor in the second round of the Battle for Atlantis. Say they move on, they beat Syracuse. Is that almost just as important? Or is taking down Syracuse, you know, a fellow Northeastern team, just as good of a win?
First off, some people in Virginia might say Northeast is a little generous for Virginia.
I thought about that, you know, thinking about, you know, before it's kind of, I asked it's kind that of in, question, in between. But it's on the border.
Yeah, it's just controversial. I'm sure people in Virginia are like, oh my God, he said what? But now I'm just messing with you. But in terms of Baylor, I did see that on the schedule, and I don't want to get my hopes up too much because I'm really excited to see Baylor. I love to see VCU play against Baylor. I don't know if it would turn out very well. Again, defending champions turn out very well for VCU, but again, that'd be a hugely important game. Even for the eye test, say they only lose by 5 or 6, keep it close in the neutral floor. I know the net is wins and losses. I know the margin of victory doesn't come in as big of a factor. But in terms of the eye test, if VCU can play Baylor close, that's huge because they're the defending champions, obviously. And they're a team that I know they've lost good players, Davion Mitchell, guys like that. But they can still maybe run the table in their non-conference. That's always on the table for a defending champion like Baylor. But again, measuring stick game, see exactly how good you are. And of course you knock off Syracuse. That's the number one thing, because that's a more winnable game, obviously, because if you get the Baylor, that's kind of like the dessert. But yeah, I would love to see them play Baylor. I would love to see how the team measures up, and it would be hugely important to at least play it close and make it a good game. And be able to win, that's even better, because that's a definite quad one win, and that is not going to drop out of quad one, especially in a neutral on a neutral site.
I definitely think for a team like a VCU or really any, you know, upper level Atlantic 10 team, like the Battle for Atlantis is one of, like you said, Sam, like one of the premier preseason tournaments. I think it's like that one, the Maui Invitational comes to mind. But those are high level power teams, high major teams. Those are blue blood programs like a Syracuse and Baylor, you know, is the reigning national champion. For if I'm VCU, I'm looking at those games as not as like, it's a very low risk and a very high reward. If you can take a win against a Baylor or a Syracuse, I think that more than bolsters your resume. But, you know, you take a loss to one of those teams, and I don't think anyone on the national level or on the committee is really going to judge you too much for it. But if I'm looking at that VCU schedule, I'm actually, like we talked, if we want to talk about the injuries in the backcourt, I think that at Vanderbilt in November 17th, Jason, how do you think Mike Rhodes is going to plan for defending against Scottie Pippen Jr.? Because he is really one of the better young players in the country at a Vanderbilt program that's trying to, you know, rally back under Jerry Stackhouse.
Right. Just kind of throw everything at him and see what sticks. I mean, again, super early in the season, which kind of stinks for VCU because, as I mentioned, that's still kind of their feeling out range. I believe that's only their third game. They get the two home games early on against the lower tier schools, your St. Peter's and your Wagner's. But again, that's going to be a challenging game as well. But I always like to have VCU be able to build the schedule. Like you mentioned with Travis Ford and St. Louis, they always built these very, I like the term you use, the low risk, high reward, because nobody really outside of Richmond is going to think that VCU has a chance against Vanderbilt and Scottie Pippen Jr., obviously one of the best collegiate players in the country. But again, if you're able to play it close, pass the eye test, and if you're able to even sneak a win, which is unlikely, but, you know, anything can happen. It's college basketball. I saw Evansville beat Kentucky once, and that was one of the biggest spread upsets I've ever seen. But Yeah, in terms of how to defend Scottie Pippen Jr., I guess you just throw everything at him and pray, because he's obviously higher caliber than any player on VCU. But don't sleep on the defense. There's always had very good defensive players at VCU. Again, I bring up Hassan Ward. I don't know how well they'd really match up based on those two opposing play styles. But VCU always has the Havoc mentality and the Havoc defense. And again, they don't play Vanderbilt very much. So you don't know. Maybe they're not going to be surprised. They're going to be surprised at what Rhodes might be able to throw at them. So, yeah, that's a huge challenge to start the season. Obviously, it would have been more ideal to schedule it, say, where the Penn State game is in mid-December, so you kind of know your lineups and things more by then. But, yeah, definitely, again, like you said, a good one to circle on the calendar.
No doubt. And so, you know, kind of moving on from VCU and talking about, you know, broader things that we learned at Atlantic 10 Media Day this week, they announced that the tournament, the men's championship tournament, will be hosted this year at the Capital One Arena in D.C., which is the home of the Wizards, the Capitals, the Mystics. Do you guys like this move? I mean, for me personally, I didn't realize how concentrated the A-10 was in the DMV until, you know, reading the poll today and reflecting on where the venue is. I mean, what do you guys think of Capital One Arena, Grant?
Jason, you're a Virginia guy.
Yeah, I went there. I think it was the last, no, it was 2018, I think it was when I went there for 2018 tournament when it was at Cap One. Like you said, Sam, you don't realize how concentrated the conference really is, because the conference started, the A-10 conference, when it began decades and decades ago as a more northeastern conference, and it seems to have shifted a little bit further south as time has gone on. You got George Washington can pretty much walk to Cap One because they're in Foggy Bottom, D.C. You got George Mason, you got Richmond, VCU, obviously. I always love having it in D.C. because I was in New York a couple of years ago, and of course, New York, to me, isn't as central for the conference, even though it has a longer history in the Northeast. I like having it in D.C. It's central, say, your Pennsylvania teams. I mean, everything's far from St. Louis because they're so far west. But yeah, I always like having the move. It's a nice stadium. Obviously, the Wizards play there, so it's NBA caliber. I mean, Barclays is too. It's a good stadium. Love the location. Virginia guy biased. It's within driving range for me, so it's perfect for being able to go see the games. Selfish note, but I love having it in that central location, and I'm very interested to see them back. And I'm sure a lot of the teams, say, in the DMV area, and even your teams in Pennsylvania, your LaSalle's, would be excited to be. Actually, I don't know. LaSalle's actually not that far from New York either. But, yeah, your DMV schools and Davidson, teams like that, a lot closer to them. And maybe their fans will be able to travel a lot more than, say, if it were at Barclays like it used to be.
Yeah, definitely. Like what Jason said, I do. You know, the DMV feels more like A-10 country right now than Brooklyn. Super cool venue at Barclays Center. But. Yeah, I do think the DMV is definitely a place you kind of want to keep moving. I think it's a good idea by the conference to keep moving around where they're doing their tournament every year, and, you know, trying to drum up interest in different regions of the conference. And yeah, I definitely think that's an interesting idea, and I think it'll go well, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm a New York guy myself, so I enjoyed the tournament being at the Barclays Center. It was a very easy commute for me from Fordham, but you know, it's crazy to think that UMass is probably the northernmost school in the Atlantic 10 Conference now, especially in a conference where, you know, a lot of the fans, it's hard to draw fans compared to an ACC school or an SEC school where, you know, most of the fans are probably people who are alumni of the school, students of the school, or people who have connection to the 14 schools in the conference. So I think something, you know, a big benefit of having it at Capital One Arena is, you know, you can draw that foot traffic. You can draw those casual fans who, you know, Washington is a great sports city. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we've seen two championships there in the past 5 years in various sports, but I don't think they're as saturated of a sports culture as they are, as they are in New York. So, you know, I'm all for it. So yeah, that pretty much covers everything we wanted to go over this week on the A-10 Talk podcast. Anything else from Media Day that caught your guys' eye that you wanted to kind of get out there? I mean, how did you feel about having the inclusion of the women's programs in Media Day this week? I mean, I thought that was a great idea, especially, you know, kind of getting the programs out there.
Definitely. I agree. Because typically I don't think a lot of the media people would cover, say they had a separate men's and women's, you lose a lot of the media, but if you have them both combined, they're all already there. I know I wouldn't have sat in on VCU women's had it not been a combined event. I even realized it was a combined event because after Mike Rose stopped talking, they said, okay, now we're bringing in the women's players. So like, oh, cool. I kept my recorder on and took my notes and actually learned a lot. And I was actually kind of embarrassed. I didn't know more about the VCU women's team than I really should. So it's good for the conference. I like the announcement they had about, I believe their conference tournament is in Delaware, which is completely neutral for A-10, but again, kind of a central location. It's different than, say, they used to have it in Richmond. I thought that was a little bit too close to your Richmonds and your VCUs of the world. But I love having the women's teams involved as well.
Yeah, it's super cool. It's a good play by the A-10, PR-wise, definitely. Seems like a lot more people are getting interested in all that. And the women's as well. I think a lot of people are, you know, they're getting a lot more exposure than they used to, which is good.
Yeah, and, you know, if you're listening and you want to get more involved in A-10's women's hoops, we've got a great selection of guys on the A-10 Talk blog that are working on full team breakdowns of every women's program in the A-10. I know Zach Weiss is working on it. Daniel Frank, one of our top contributors to the website, are putting together some really, really great previews of all 14 women's basketball programs. So if you've got the time and you want to check them out, just head right over to A10talk.com. I mean, along with everything that we're working on, you know, I'm working on Fordham stuff, Grant's working on SLU stuff, Jason's working on VCU. You know, we've got a great cast of contributors over at A10 Talk. And so with that, I think that'll keep us satisfied until next week. Thanks a lot, guys, for coming on, and I'll see you later.